You don't dare ignore me, he says as the bells tinkle and chime over his head. He crosses Hanover Street, parks in the strip mall, kills the engine, the annoying chimes fall blessedly silent, and hauls his laptop out from under the seat. He keeps it in an insulated case because the truck is always so fucking cold. He boots it up and goes on Debbie's blue umbrella, courtesy of the nearby coffee shop's Wi-Fi. Nothing.
You fucker, Brady whispers. You don't dare ignore me, you fucker.
As he zips the laptop back into its case, he sees a couple of boys standing outside the comic book shop, talking and looking at him and grinning. Given his 5 years of experience, Brady estimates that they're sixth or seventh graders with a combined IQ of 120 and a long future of collecting unemployment checks, or a short one in some desert country. They approach, the goofier looking of the pair in the lead. Smiling, Brady leans out his window. Help you boys?
We want to know if you got Jerry Garcia in there,
Goofy says. No, Brady says, smiling more widely than ever. But if I did, I'd sure let him out. They look so ridiculously disappointed, Brady almost laughs. Instead, he points down at Goofy's pants. Your fly's unzipped, he says, and when Goofy looks down, Brady flicks a finger at the soft underside of his chin. A little harder than he intended, actually quite a lot, but what the hell?
Gotcha,
Brady says merrily. Goofy smiles to show yes, he's been gotten, but there's a red wheal just above his Adam's apple and surprised tears swim in his eyes. Goofy and not quite so Goofy start away. Goofy looks back over his shoulder. His lower lip is pushed out and now he looks like a third grader instead of just another pre-adolescent cum stain who'll be fucking up the halls of Beale Middle School come September.
That really hurt, he says with a kind of wonder.
Brady's mad at himself. A finger flick hard enough to bring tears to the kid's eyes means he's telling the straight-up truth. It also means Goofy and not quite so Goofy will remember him. Brady can apologize, can even give them free cones to show his sincerity, but then they'll remember that. It's a small thing, but small things mount up and then maybe you have a big thing.
Sorry, he says and means it. I was just kidding around, son.
Goofy gives him the finger, and not quite so Goofy adds his own middle digit to show solidarity. They go into the comic store where, if Brady knows boys like these, and he does, they will be invited to either buy or leave after 5 minutes browsing. They'll remember him. Goofy might even tell his parents, and his parents might lodge a complaint with Loeb's. It's unlikely, but not impossible, and whose fault was it that he'd given Goofy Boy's unprotected neck a snap hard enough to leave a mark instead of just the gentle flick he'd intended? The ex-cop has knocked Brady off balance. He's making him screw things up, and Brady doesn't like that. He starts the ice cream truck's engine. The bells begin bonging a tune from the loudspeaker on the roof. Brady turns left on Hanover Street and resumes his daily round, selling cones and Happy Boys and Pola bars, spreading sugar on the afternoon, and obeying all speed limits.
9. Although there are plenty of parking spaces on Lake Avenue after 7 p.m., as Olivia Trelawney well knew, they are few and far between at 5 in the afternoon when Hodges and Janie Patterson get back from Sunny Acres. Hodges spots one 3 or 4 buildings down, however, and although it's small, the car behind the empty spot is poached a little. He shoehorns the Toyota into it quickly and easily.
I'm impressed, Janie says. I could never have done that. I flunked my driver's test on parallel parking the first 2 times I went.
You must have had a hard ass.
She smiles. The 3rd time I wore a short skirt, and that did the trick.
Thinking about how much he'd like to see her in a short skirt, the shorter the better, Hodges says. There's really no trick to it. If you back toward the curb at a 45-degree angle, you can't go wrong. Unless your car's too big, that is. A Toyota's perfect for city parking. Not like a...
He stops. Not like a Mercedes, she finishes. Come up and have coffee, Bill. I'll even feed the meter.
I'll feed it. In fact, I'll max it out. We've got a lot to talk about.
You learned some stuff from my mom, didn't you? That's why you were so quiet all the way back.
I did, and I'll fill you in, but that's not where the conversation starts.
He's looking at her full in the face now, and it's an easy face to look into.
Christ, he wishes he were 15 years younger. Even 10. I need to be straight with you. I think you're under the impression that I came looking for work, and that's not the case.
No, she says. I think you came because you feel guilty about what happened to my sister. I simply took advantage of you. I'm not sorry either. You were good with my mother. Kind. Very, very gentle.
She's close. Her eyes a darker blue in the afternoon light, and very wide. Her lips open as if she has more to say, but he doesn't give her a chance. He kisses her before he can think about how stupid it is, how reckless, and is astounded when she kisses him back, even putting her right hand on the nape of his neck to make their contact a little firmer. It goes on for no more than 5 seconds, but it seems much longer to Hodges, who hasn't had a kiss like this one in quite a while. She pulls back, brushes a hand through his hair, and says,
I've wanted to do that all afternoon. Now let's go upstairs. I'll make coffee and you make your report.
But there's no report until much later, and no coffee at all. 10. He kisses her again in the elevator. This time her hands link behind his neck, and his travel down past the small of her back to the white pants snug across her bottom. He is aware of his too big stomach pressing against her trim one and thinks she must be revolted by it, but when the elevator opens, her cheeks are flushed, her eyes are bright, and she's showing small white teeth in a smile. She takes his hand and pulls him down the short hall between the elevator and the apartment door.
Come on, she says. Come on, we're going to do this, so come on, before one of us gets cold feet.
It won't be me, Hodges thinks. Every part of him is warm. At first she can't open the door because the hand holding the key is shaking too badly. It makes her laugh. He closes his fingers over hers, and together they push the Schlage into the slot. The apartment where he first met this woman's sister and mother is shadowy because the sun has traveled around to the other side of the building. The lake has darkened to a cobalt so deep it's almost purple. There are no sailboats, but he can see a freighter.
Come on. She says again, come on, Bill, don't quit on me now.
Then they're in one of the bedrooms. He doesn't know if it's Janie's or the one Olivia used on her Thursday night stays, and he doesn't care. The life of the last few months, the afternoon TV, the microwave dinners, his father's Smith & Wesson revolver, seems so distant that it might have belonged to a fictional character in a boring foreign movie. She tries to pull the striped sailor shirt over her head and it gets caught on the clip in her hair. She gives a frustrated, muffled laugh.
Help me with this damn thing, would you please?
He runs his hands up her smooth sides. She gives a tiny jump at his initial touch, and beneath the inside-out shirt. He stretches the fabric and lifts. Her head pops free. She's laughing and little out-of-breath gasps. Her bra is plain white cotton. He holds her by the waist and kisses between her breasts as she unbuckles his belt and pops the button on his slacks. He thinks, if I'd known this could happen at this stage of my life, I would have gotten back to the gym. Why? He begins.
Oh, shut up.
She slides a hand down the front of him, pushing the zipper with her palm. His pants fall around his shoes in a jingle of change.
Save the talk for later.
She grabs the hardness of him through his underpants and wiggles it like a gear shift, making him gasp.
That's a good start. Don't go limp on me, Bill, don't you dare.
They fall onto the bed. Hodges still in his boxer shorts, Janie in cotton panties as plain as her bra. He tries to roll her onto her back, but she resists.
You're not getting on top of me, she says. If you have a heart attack while we're screwing, you'll crush me.
If I have a heart attack while we're screwing, I'll be the most disappointed man to ever leave this world.
Stay still. Just stay still.
She hooks her thumbs into the sides of his boxers. He cups her hanging breasts as she does it.
Now lift your legs, and keep busy. Use your thumbs a little. I like that.
He's able to obey both of these commands with no trouble. He's always been a multitasker. A moment later, she's looking down at him, a lock of her hair tumbled over one of her eyes. She sticks out her lower lip and blows it back.
Keep still. Let me do the work, and stay with me. I don't mean to be bossy, but I haven't had sex in 2 years, and the last I did have sucked. I want to enjoy this. I deserve it.
The clinging, slippery warmth of her encloses him in a warm hug, and he can't help raising his hips.
Stay still, I said.
Next time you can move all you want, but this is mine.
It's difficult, but he does as she says.
Her hair tumbles into her eyes again, and this time she can't use her lower lip to blow it back because she's gnawing at it in little bites he thinks she'll feel later. She spreads both hands and rubs them roughly through the graying hair on his chest, then down to the embarrassing swell of his gut.
I need to lose some weight, he gasps.
You need to shut up, she says, then moves just a little and closes her eyes. Oh, God, that's deep. And nice. You can worry about your diet program later, okay? She begins to move again, pauses once to readjust the angle, then settles into a rhythm.
I don't know how long I can...
You better. Her eyes are still closed. You just better hold out, Detective Hodges. Count prime numbers. Think of the books you liked when you were a kid. Spell xylophone backwards. Just stay with me. I won't need long. He stays with her just long enough.
11. Sometimes when he's feeling upset, Brady Hartsfield retraces the route of his greatest triumph. It soothes him. On this Friday night, he doesn't go home after turning in the ice cream truck and making the obligatory joke or two with Shirley Orton in the front office. He drives his clunker downtown instead, not liking the front-end shimmy or the too loud blat of the engine. Soon he will have to balance off the cost of a new car, a new used car, against the cost of repairs. And his mother's Honda needs work even more desperately than his Subaru does. Not that she drives the Honda very often these days, and that's good, considering how much of her time she spends in the bag. His trip down memory lane begins on Lake Avenue, just past the bright lights of downtown, where Mrs. Trelawney always parked her Mercedes on Thursday nights and winds up Marlborough Street to City Center. Only this evening, he gets no further than the condo. He brakes so suddenly that the car behind almost rear-ends him. The driver hits his horn in a long, outraged blast, but Brady pays no attention. It might as well have been a foghorn on the other side of the lake. The driver pulls around and buzzing down his passenger side window to yell, "Asshole!" at the top of his lungs. Brady pays no attention to that either. There must be thousands of Toyota Corollas in the city and hundreds of blue Toyota Corollas. But how many blue Toyota Corollas with bumper stickers reading, "Support your local police"? Brady is betting there's just one. And what the hell is the fat ex-cop doing in the old lady's condominium apartment? Why is he visiting Mrs. Trelawney's sister, who now lives there? The answer seems obvious. Detective Hodges, Rhett, is hunting. Brady is no longer interested in reliving last year's triumph. He pulls an illegal and completely out-of-character U-turn, now heading for the north side. Heading for home with a single thought in his head, blinking on and off like a neon sign. You bastard. You bastard. You bastard. Things are not going the way they are supposed to. Things are slipping out of his control. It's not right. Something needs to be done.
12. As the stars come out over the lake, Hodges and Janie Patterson sit in the kitchen nook, gobbling takeout Chinese and drinking oolong tea. Janie is wearing a fluffy white bathrobe. Hodges is in his boxers and T-shirt. When he used the bathroom after making love, she was curled in the middle of the bed dozing. He got on her scale and was delighted to see he's 4 pounds lighter than the last time he weighed himself. It's a start. Why me? Hodges says now. Don't get me wrong, I feel incredibly lucky, even blessed, but I'm 62 and overweight. She sips tea.
Well, let's think about that, shall we? In one of the old detective movies Ollie and I used to watch on TV when we were kids, I'd be the greedy vixen. Maybe a nightclub cigarette girl who tries to charm the crusty and cynical private detective with her fair white body. Only I'm not the greedy type, nor do I have to be, considering the fact that I recently inherited several $1 million, and my fair white body has started to sag in several vital places, as you may have noticed.
He hasn't. What he has noticed is that she hasn't answered his question, so he waits.
Not good enough.
Nope.
Janie rolls her eyes. I wish I could think of a way to answer you that's gentler than men are very stupid, or more elegant than I was horny and wanted to brush away the cobwebs. I'm not coming up with much, so let's go with those. Plus, I was attracted to you. It's been 30 years since I was a dewy debutante and much too long since I got laid. I'm 44, and that allows me to reach for what I want. I don't always get it, but I'm allowed to reach.
He stares at her, honestly amazed. 44?
She bursts into laughter.
You know what? That looks the nicest compliment I've had in a long, long time. And the most honest one. Just that stare. So I'm going to push it a little. How old did you think I was?
Maybe 40, at the outside, which would make me a cradle robber.
Oh, bullshit. If you were the one with the money instead of me, everyone would take the younger woman thing for granted. In that case, people would take it for granted if you were sleeping with a 25-year-old. She pauses. Although that would be cradle robbing, in my humble opinion.
Still.
You're old, but not that old, and you're on the heavyweight side, but not that heavy. Although you will be if you keep on the way you're going. She points her fork at him. That's the kind of honesty a woman can only afford after she's slept with a man and still likes him well enough to eat dinner with him. I said I haven't had sex in 2 years. That's true. But do you know when I last had sex with a man I actually liked? He shakes his head. Try junior college. And he wasn't a man, he was a second-string tackle with a big red pimple on the end of his nose. He was very sweet, though. Clumsy and far too quick, but sweet. He actually cried on my shoulder afterward.
So, this wasn't just... I don't know.
A thank you fuck? A mercy fuck? Give me a little credit. And here's a promise.
She leans forward, the robe gaping to show the shadowed valley between her breasts.
Lose 20 pounds, and I'll risk you on top.
He can't help laughing.
It was great, Bill. I have no regrets, and I have a thing for big guys. The tackle with the pimple on his nose went about 240. My ex was a beanpole, and I should have known no good could come of it the first time I saw him. Can we leave it at that?
Yeah.
Yeah, she says, smiling, and stands up. Come on in the living room. It's time for you to make your report.
13.
He tells her everything except for his long afternoons watching bad TV and flirting with his father's old service revolver. She listens gravely, not interrupting, her eyes seldom leaving his face. When he's done, she gets a bottle of wine out of the fridge and pours them each a glass. They are big glasses, and he looks at his doubtfully. Don't know if I should, Janie. I'm driving.
Not tonight, you're not. You're staying here. Unless you've got a dog or a cat.
Hodges shakes his head.
Not even a parrot?
In one of those old movies, you'd at least have a parrot in your office that would say rude things to prospective clients. Sure, and you'd be my receptionist, Lola, instead of Janie.
Or Velma.
He grins. There's a wavelength, and they're on it. She leans forward, once again creating that enticing view.
Profile this guy for me.
That was never my job. We had guys who specialized in that, one on the force and two on call from the psych department at the state university.
Do it anyway. I googled you, you know, and it looks to me like you were just about the best the police department had. Commendations up the wazoo.
I got lucky a few times. It comes out sounding falsely modest, but luck really is a big part of it. Luck and being ready. Woody Allen was right. 80% of success is just showing up.
Take a shot, okay? If you do a good job, maybe we'll revisit the bedroom. She wrinkles her nose at him. Unless you're too old for twosies.
The way he feels right now, he might not be too old for threesies. There have been a lot of celibate nights, which gives him an account to draw on. Or so he hopes. Part of him, a large part, still can't believe this isn't an incredibly detailed dream.
He sips his wine, rolling it around in his mouth, giving himself time to think. The top of her robe is closed again, which helps him concentrate. Okay. He's probably young, that's the first thing. I'm guessing between 20 and 35. That's partly because of his computer savvy, but not entirely. When an older guy murders a bunch of people, the ones he mostly goes after are family, co-workers, or both, then he finishes by putting the gun to his own head. You look, you find a reason. A motive. Wife kicked him out, then got a restraining order.
Boss downsized him, then humiliated him by having a couple of security guys stand by while he cleaned out his office. Loans overdue, credit cards maxed out, house underwater, car repoed.
But what about serial killers? Wasn't that guy in Kansas a middle-aged man?
Dennis Rader, yeah. And he was middle-aged when they bagged him, but only 30 or so when he started. Also, those were sex killings. Mr. Mercedes isn't a sex killer, and he's not a serial killer in the traditional sense. He started with a bunch, but since then he's settled on individuals. First your sister, now me. And he didn't come after either of us with a gun or a stolen car, did he?
Not yet, anyway, Janie says.
Our guy is a hybrid, but he has certain things in common with younger men who kill. He's more like Lee Malvo, one of the Beltway snipers, than Raider. Malvo and his partner planned to kill 6 white people a day. Just random killings. Whoever had the bad luck to walk into their gun sights went down. Sex and age didn't matter. They ended up getting 10. Not a bad score for a couple of homicidal maniacs. The stated motive was racial, and with John Allen Muhammad, he was Malvo's partner, much older, a kind of father figure, that might have been true, or partially true. I think Malvo's motivation was a lot more complex. A whole stew of things he didn't understand himself. Look closely and you'd probably find sexual confusion and upbringing were major players. I think the same is true with our guy. He's young. He's bright. He's good at fitting in. So good that a lot of his associates don't realize he's basically a loner. When he's caught, they'll all say, "I can't believe it was so-and-so. He was always so nice."
Like Dexter Morgan on that TV show.
Hodges knows the one she's talking about and shakes his head emphatically, not just because the show is Fantasyland bullshit, either. Dexter knows why he's doing what he's doing. Our guy doesn't. He's almost certainly unmarried. He doesn't date. He may be impotent. There's a good chance he's still living at home. If so, it's probably with a single parent. If it's father, the relationship is cold and distant. Ships passing in the night. If it's mother, there's a good chance Mr. Mercedes is her surrogate husband.
He sees her start to speak and raises his hand.
That doesn't mean they're having a sexual relationship.
Maybe not, but I'll tell you something, Bill. You don't have to sleep with a guy to be having a sexual relationship with him. Sometimes it's in the eye contact, or the clothes you wear when you know he's going to be around, or what you do with your hands, touching, patting, caressing, hugging. Sex has got to be in this somewhere. I mean, that letter he sent you. The stuff about wearing a condom while he did it. She shivers in her white robe.
90% of that letter is white noise, but sure, sex is in it somewhere. Always is. Also anger, aggression, loneliness, feelings of inadequacy. But it doesn't do to get lost in stuff like that. It's not profiling, it's analysis, which was way above my pay grade even when I had a pay grade.
Okay.
He's broken. Hodges says simply. And evil. Like an apple that looks okay on the outside, but when you cut it open, it's black and full of worms.
Evil, she says, almost sighing the word, then to herself rather than him. Of course he is. He battened on my sister like a vampire.
He could have some kind of job where he meets the public because he's got a fair amount of surface charm. If so, it's probably a low-paying job. He never advances because he's unable to combine his above-average intelligence with long-term concentration. His actions suggest he's a creature of impulse and opportunity. The city center killings are a perfect example. I think he had his eye on your sister's Mercedes, but I don't think he knew what he was actually going to do with it until just a few days before the job fair. Maybe only a few hours. I just wish I could figure out how he stole it. He pauses, thinking that thanks to Jerome, he has a good idea about half of it. The spare key was very likely in the glove compartment all along. I think ideas for murder flip through this guy's head as fast as cards in a good dealer's fast shuffle. He's probably thought of blowing up airliners, setting fires, shooting up school buses, poisoning the water system, maybe assassinating the governor or the president.
Jesus, Bill.
Right now he's fixated on me, and that's good. It will make him easier to catch. It's good for another reason, too.
Which is?
I'd rather keep him thinking small. Keep him thinking one-on-one. The longer he keeps doing that, the longer it will be before he decides to try putting on another horror show like the one at City Center, maybe on an even grander scale.
You know what creeps me out? He's probably already got a list of potential targets.
Didn't he say in his letter that he had no urge to do it again?
He grins. It lights up his whole face. Yeah, he did. And you know how you tell when guys like this are lying? Their lips are moving. Only in the case of Mr. Mercedes, he's writing letters.
Or communicating with his targets on the Blue Umbrella site, like he did with Ollie.
Yeah.
If we assume he succeeded with her because she was psychologically fragile. Forgive me, Bill, but does he have a reason to believe he can succeed with you for the same reason?
He looks at his glass of wine and sees it's empty. He starts to pour himself another half a glass, thinks what that might do to his chances of a successful return engagement in the bedroom, and settles for a small puddle in the bottom instead.
Bill.
Maybe, he says. Since my retirement, I've been drifting. But I'm not as lost as your sister. Not anymore, at least. And that's not the important thing. It's not the takeaway from the letters and from the Blue Umbrella communications.
Then what is?
He's been watching. That's the takeaway. It makes him vulnerable. Unfortunately, it also makes him dangerous to my known associates. I don't think he knows I've been talking to you.
Quite a bit more than talking, she says, giving her eyebrows a groucho waggle.
But he knows Olivia had a sister, and we have to assume he knows you're in the city. You need to start being super careful. Make sure your door is locked when you're here.
I always do.
And don't believe what you hear on the lobby intercom. Anyone can say he's from a package service and needs a signature. Visually identify all comers before you open your door. Be aware of your surroundings when you go out. He leans forward, the splash of wine untouched. He doesn't want it anymore. Big thing here, Janie. When you are out, keep an eye on traffic. Not just driving, but when you're on foot. Do you know the term BOLO?
Cops speak for be on the lookout.
That's it. When you're out, you're going to BOLO any vehicles that seem to keep reappearing in your immediate vicinity.
Like that lady's black SUVs, she says, smiling. Mrs. Who's a what's it?
Mrs. Melbourne, thinking of her tickles some obscure associational switch in the back of Hodge's mind, but it's gone before he can track it down, let alone scratch it. Jerome's got to be on the lookout, too. If Mr. Mercedes is cruising Hodge's place, he'll have seen Jerome mowing the lawn, putting on the screens, cleaning out the gutters. Both Jerome and Janie are probably safe, but probably isn't good enough. Mr. Mercedes is a random bundle of homicide, and Hodges is set out on a course of deliberate provocation. Janie reads his mind.
And yet you're... what did you call it? Winding him up.
Yeah. And very shortly I'm going to steal some time on your computer and wind him up a little more. I had a message all worked out, but I'm thinking of adding something. My partner got a big solve today, and there's a way I can use that.
What was it?
There's no reason not to tell her. It will be in the papers tomorrow, Sunday at the latest. Turnpike Joe.
The one who kills women at rest stops.
And when he nods.
Does he fit your profile of Mr. Mercedes?
Not at all. But there's no reason for our guy to know that.
What do you mean to do?
Hodges tells her. 14. They don't have to wait for the morning paper. The news that Donald Davis, already under suspicion for the murder of his wife, has confessed to the Turnpike Joe killings leads the 11 p.m. news. Hodges and Janie watch it in bed. For Hodges, the return engagement has been strenuous but sublimely satisfactory. He's still out of breath. He's sweaty and in need of a shower, but it's been a long, long time since he felt this happy. This complete. When the newscaster moves on to a puppy stuck in a drainpipe, Janie uses the remote to kill the TV.
Okay, it could work. But God, is it risky?
He shrugs. With no police resources to call on, I see it as my best way forward. And it's fine with him. Because it's the way he wants to go forward. He thinks briefly of the makeshift but very effective weapon he keeps in his dresser drawer, the Argyle sock filled with ball bearings. He imagines how satisfying it would be to use the happy slapper on the son of a bitch who ran one of the world's heaviest passenger sedans into a crowd of defenseless people. That probably won't happen, but it's possible. In this best and worst of all worlds, most things are.
What did you make of what my mother said at the end about Olivia hearing ghosts?
I need to think about that a little more, Hodges says, but he's already thought about it, and if he's right, he might have another path to Mr. Mercedes. Given his druthers, he wouldn't involve Jerome Robinson any more than he already has, but if he's going to follow up on old Mrs. Wharton's parting shot, he may have to. He knows half a dozen cops with Jerome's computer savvy and can't call on a single one of them. Ghosts, he thinks. Ghosts in the machine. He sits up and swings his feet out onto the floor. If I'm still invited to stay over, what I need right now is a shower.
You are.
She leans over and sniffs at the side of his neck, her hand lightly clamped on his upper arm, giving him a pleasurable shiver.
And you certainly do.
When he's showered and back in his boxers, he asks her to power up her computer. Then, with her sitting beside him and looking on attentively, he slips under Debbie's blue umbrella and leaves a message for Merce Kill. 15 minutes later, and with Janie Patterson nestled next to him, he sleeps, and never so well since childhood.
15. When Brady gets home after several hours of aimless cruising, it's late and there's a note on the back door. Where you been, honey boy? There's homemade lasagna in the oven.
He only has to look at the unsteady down-slanting script to know she was seriously loaded when she wrote it. He untacks the note and lets himself in. Usually he checks on her first thing, but he smells smoke and hustles to the kitchen, where a blue haze hangs in the air. Thank God the smoke detector in here is dead. He keeps meaning to replace it and keeps forgetting too many other fish to fry. Thanks are also due for the powerful stove fan, which has sucked up just enough smoke to keep the rest of the detectors from going off, although they soon will if he can't air the place out. The oven is set at 350. He turns it off. He opens the windows over the sink, then the back door. There's a floor fan in the utility closet where they keep the cleaning supplies. He sets it up facing the runaway stove and turns it on at the highest setting. With that done, he finally goes into the living room and checks on his mother. She's crashed out on the couch, wearing a house dress that's open up top and rucked to her thighs below, snoring so loudly and steadily she sounds like an idling chainsaw. He averts his eyes and goes back into the kitchen, muttering, "Fuck, fuck, fuck, fuck," under his breath. He sits at the table with his head bent, his palms cupping his temples, and his fingers plunged deep into his hair. Why is it that when things go wrong, they have to keep on going wrong? He finds himself thinking of the Morton Salt motto, "When it rains, it pours." After 5 minutes of airing out, he risks opening the oven. As he regards the black and smoking lump within, any faint hunger pangs he might have felt when he got home pass away. Washing will not clean that pan. An hour of scouring and a whole box of Brillo pads will not clean that pan. An industrial laser probably wouldn't clean that pan. That pan is a gone goose. It's only luck that he didn't get home to find the fucking fire department here and his mother offering them vodka Collinses. He shuts the oven. He doesn't want to look at that nuclear meltdown, and goes back to look at his mother instead. Even as his eyes are running up and down her bare legs, he's thinking it would be better if she did die. Better for her and better for me. He goes downstairs, using his voice commands to turn on the lights in his bank of computers. He goes to number 3, centers the cursor on the blue umbrella icon, and hesitates. Not because he's afraid there won't be a message from the FedEx cop, but because he's afraid there will be. If so, it won't be anything he wants to read. Not the way things are going. His head is fucked up already, so why fuck it up more? Except there might be an answer to what the cop was doing at the Lake Avenue condo. Has he been questioning Olivia Trelawney's sister? Probably. At 62, he's surely not boffing her. Brady clicks the mouse, and sure enough, Kermit Frog 19 wants to chat with you. Do you want to chat with Kermit Frog 19? Why? N. Brady settles the cursor on N and circles the curved back of his mouse with the pad of his index finger, daring himself to push it and end this thing right here and right now. It's obvious he won't be able to nudge the fat ex-cop into suicide the way he did Mrs. Trelawney, so why not? Isn't that the smart thing? But he has to know. More importantly, the dead rat doesn't get to win. He moves the cursor to Y, clicks, and the message, quite a long one this time, flashes onto the screen.
If it isn't my false confessing friend again, I shouldn't even respond. Guys like you are a dime a dozen, but as you point out, I'm retired, and even talking to a nut is better than Dr. Phil and all those late-night infomercials. One more 30-minute OxyClean ad, and I'll be as crazy as you are. Ha ha ha. Also, I owe you thanks for introducing me to this site, which I otherwise would not have found. I have already made 3 new and non-crazy friends. One is a lady with a delightfully dirty mouth. So, okay, my friend, let me clue you in. First, anyone who watches CSI could figure out that the Mercedes killer was wearing a hairnet and used bleach on the clown mask. I mean, duh. Second, if you were really the guy who stole Mrs. Trelawney's Mercedes, you would have mentioned the valet key. That's something you couldn't have figured out from watching CSI. So at the risk of repeating myself, duh. Third, I hope you're taking notes. I got a call from my old partner today. He caught a bad guy, one who specializes in true confessions. Check the news, my friend, and then guess what else this guy's going to confess to in the next week or so. Have a nice night, and BTW, why don't you go bother someone else with your fantasies?
Brady vaguely remembers some cartoon character. Maybe it was Foghorn Leghorn, the big rooster with the southern accent, who would get so mad first his neck, and then his head would turn into a thermometer, with the temperature going up and up from bake to broil to nuke. Brady can almost feel that happening to him as he reads this arrogant, insulting, infuriating post.
Valet key? Valet key? What are you talking about? He says, his voice somewhere between a whisper and a growl. What the fuck are you talking about?
He gets up and strides around in an unsteady circle on legs like stilts, yanking at his hair so hard his eyes water. His mother is forgotten. The blackened lasagna is forgotten. Everything is forgotten except for this hateful post. He has even had the nerve to put in a smiley face.
A smiley face?
Brady kicks his chair, hurting his toes and sending it rolling all the way across the room where it bangs the wall. Then he turns and runs back to his number 3 computer, hunching over it like a vulture. His first impulse is to reply immediately, to call the fucking cop a liar, an idiot with fat-induced early-onset Alzheimer's, an anal ranger who sucks his nigger yard boy's cock. Then some semblance of rationality, fragile and wavering, reasserts itself. He retrieves his chair and goes to the city paper's website. He doesn't even have to click on breaking news in order to see what Hodges has been raving about. It's right there on the front page of tomorrow's paper. Brady follows local crime news assiduously and knows both Donald Davis's name and his handsomely chiseled features. He knows the cops have been chasing Davis for the murder of his wife, and Brady has no doubt the man did it. Now the idiot has confessed, but not just to her murder. According to the newspaper story, Davis has also confessed to the rape murders of 5 more women. In short, he's claiming to be Turnpike Joe. At first, Brady is unable to connect this with the fat ex-cop's hectoring message. Then it comes to him in a baleful burst of inspiration. While he's in a breast-bearing mood, Donnie Davis also means to confess to the city center massacre. May have done so already. Brady whirls around like a dervish. Once, twice, 3 times. His head is splitting. His pulse is thudding in his chest, his neck, his temples. He can even feel it in his gums and tongue. Did Davis say something about a valet key?
Is that what brought this on?
There was no valet key, Brady says.
Only how can he be sure of that? What if there was? And if there was?
If they hang this on Donald Davis and snatch away Brady Hartsfield's great triumph after the risks he took.
He can no longer hold back. He sits down at his number 3 again and writes a message to Kermit Frog 19. Just a short one, but his hands are shaking so badly it takes him almost 5 minutes. He sends it as soon as he's done, without bothering to read it over.
You are full of shit, you asshole. Okay, the key wasn't in the ignition, but it was no valet key. It was a spare in the glove compartment, and how I unlocked the car is for you to figure out, fuckface. Donald Davis did not do this crime. I repeat, Donald Davius did not do this crime. If you tell people he did, I will kill you, although it wouldn't be killing much as washed up as you are. Signed, the real Mercedes Killer. P.S. Your mother was a whore. She took it up the ass and licked cum out of gutters.
Brady shuts off his computer and goes upstairs, leaving his mother to snore on the couch instead of helping her to bed. He takes 3 aspirin, adds a 4th, and then lies in his own bed, wide-eyed and shaking, until the first streaks of dawn come up in the east. At last, he drops off for 2 hours, sleep that is thin and dream-haunted and unrestful.
16. Hodges is making scrambled eggs when Janie comes into the kitchen on Saturday morning in her white robe, her hair wet from the shower. With it combed back from her face, she looks younger than ever. He thinks again, 44? I looked for bacon but didn't see any. Of course, it might still be there. My ex claims that the great majority of American men suffer from the disease of refrigerator blindness. I don't know if there's a helpline for that.
She points at his midsection.
Okay, he says. And then because she seems to like it. Yeah.
And by the way, how's your cholesterol?
He smiles and says, toast? It's whole grain, as you probably know since you bought it.
1 slice, no butter, just a little jam. What are you going to do today?
Not sure yet. Although he's thinking he'd like to check in with Radney Peoples out in Sugar Heights if Radney's on duty and being vigilant. And he needs to talk to Jerome about computers. Endless vistas there.
Have you checked the blue umbrella?
Wanted to make you breakfast first. And me. It's true. He woke up actually wanting to feed his body rather than trying to plug some empty hole in his head. Also, I don't know your password.
It's Janie.
My advice? Change it. Actually, it's the advice of the kid who works for me.
Jerome, right?
That's the one. He has scrambled 6 eggs and they eat them all, split right down the middle. It has crossed his mind to ask if she had any regrets about last night, but decides the way she's going through her breakfast answers the question. With the dishes in the sink, they go on her computer and sit silently for nearly 4 minutes, reading and rereading the latest message from Merce Kill.
Holy cow, she says at last. You wanted to wind him up, and I'd say he's fully wound. Do you see all the mistakes? She points out compartment. And unlocked. Is that part of his, what did you call it, stylistic masking?
I don't think so. Hodges is looking at Woodenter and smiling. He can't help smiling. The fish is feeling the hook, and it's sunk deep. It hurts. It burns. I think that's the kind of typing you do when you're mad as hell. The last thing he expected was that he'd have a credibility problem. It's making him crazy.
She says.
Huh?
Crazy-er. Send him another message, Bill. Poke him harder. He deserves it.
All right, he thinks, then types.
17.
When he's dressed, she walks down the hall with him and treats him to a lingering kiss at the elevator.
I still can't believe last night happened, he tells her.
Oh, it did. And if you play your cards right, it might happen again.
She searches his face with those blue eyes of hers.
But no promises or long-term commitments, okay? We take it as it comes, a day at a time.
At my age, I take everything that way.
The elevator doors open. He steps in. Stay in touch, cowboy.
I will. The elevator doors start to close. He stops them with his hand. And remember to bolo, cowgirl. She nods solemnly, but he doesn't miss the twinkle in her eye.
Janie will bolo her ass off.
Keep your cell phone handy and it might be wise to program 911 on your speed dial. He drops his hand. She blows him a kiss. The doors roll shut before he can blow one back. His car is where he left it, but the meter must have run out before the free parking kicked in because there's a ticket stuck under the windshield wiper. He opens the glove compartment, stuffs the ticket inside, and fishes out his phone. He's good at giving Janie advice that he doesn't take himself. Since he pulled the pin, he's always forgetting the damn Nokia, which is pretty prehistoric as cell phones go. These days, hardly anyone calls him anyway. But this morning, he has three messages, all from Jerome. Numbers 2 and 3, one at 9:40 last night, the other at 10:45, are impatient inquiries about where he is and why he doesn't call. They are in Jerome's normal voice. The original message, left at 6:30 yesterday evening, begins in his exuberant Tyrone feel-good delight voice. Massa Hodges, where you at? I needs to jaw to y'all. Then he becomes Jerome again.
I think I know how he did it, how he stole the car. Call me.
Hodges checks his watch and decides Jerome probably won't be up quite yet, not on Saturday morning. He decides to drive over there with a stop at his house first to pick up his notes. He turns on the radio, gets Bob Seger singing old-time rock and roll, and bellows along. Take those old records off the shelf.
18. Once upon a simpler time, before apps, iPads, Samsung Galaxies, and the world of blazing fast 4G, weekends were the busiest days of the week at Discount Electronics. Now the kids who used to come in to buy CDs are downloading Vampire Weekend from iTunes while their elders are surfing eBay or watching the TV shows they missed on Hulu. This Saturday morning, the Birch Hill Mall DE is a wasteland. Tones is down front trying to sell an old lady an HD TV that's already an antique. Freddie Linklater is out back chain-smoking Marlboro Reds and probably rehearsing her latest gay rights rant. Brady is sitting at one of the computers in the back row, an ancient Vizio that he's rigged to leave no keystroke tracks, let alone a history. He's staring at Hodges' latest message. One eye, his left, has picked up a rapid, irregular tick.
Quit dumping on my mother, okay? Not her fault you got caught in a bunch of stupid lies. Got a key out of the glove compartment, did you? That's pretty good, since Olivia Trelawney had both of them. The one missing was the valet key. She kept it in a small magnetic box under the rear bumper. The real Mercedes killer must have scoped it. I think I'm done writing to you, dickwad. Your fun quotient is currently hovering around zero, and I have it on good authority that Donald Davis is going to cop to the city center killings. Which leaves you where? Just living your shitty little unexciting life, I guess. One other thing before I close this charming correspondence. You threatened to kill me. That's a felony offense, but guess what? I don't care. Buddy, you are just another chicken shit asshole. The internet is full of them. Want to come to my house? I know you know where I live. And make that threat in person? No, I thought not. Let me close with two words so simple even a thud like you should be able to understand them. Go away.
Brady's rage is so great he feels frozen in place. Yet he's also still burning.
He thinks he will stay this way, hunched over the piece of shit Vizio ridiculously sale priced at $87.87, until he either dies of frostbite, or goes up in flames, or somehow does both at the same time.
but when a shadow rises on the wall, Brady finds he can move after all. He clicks away from the fat ex-cop's message just before Freddy bends over to peer at the screen.
What you looking at, Brades? You moved awful fast to hide it, whatever it was.
The National Geographic documentary. It's called When Lesbians Attack.
Your humor, she says, might be exceeded by your sperm count, but I tend to doubt it.
Tones Frobisher joins them. Got a service call over on Edgemont, he says. Which one of you wants it?
Freddy says, given a choice between a service call in hillbilly heaven and having a wild weasel stuck up my ass, I'd have to pick the weasel.
I'll take it, Brady says.
He's decided he has an errand to run, one that can't wait.
19. Jerome's little sis and a couple of her friends are jumping rope in the Robinson driveway when Hodges arrives. All of them are wearing sparkly tees with silk screens of some boy band on them. He cuts across the lawn, his case folder in one hand. Barbara comes over long enough to give him a high five and a dap, then hurries back to grab her end of the rope. Jerome, dressed in shorts and a City College t-shirt with the sleeves torn off, is sitting on the porch steps and drinking orange juice. Odell is by his side. He tells Hodges his folks are off Krogering and he's got babysitting duty until they get back.
Not that she really needs a sitter anymore. She's a lot hipper than our parents think.
Hodges sits down beside him. You don't want to take that for granted. Trust me on this, Jerome.
Meaning what exactly?
Tell me what you came up with first.
Instead of answering, Jerome points to Hodges' car parked at the curb so as not to interfere with the girls' game. What year is that?
04. No showstopper, but it gets good mileage. Want to buy it?
I'll pass. Did you lock it?
Yeah.
Even though this is a good neighborhood and he's sitting right here looking at it, force of habit. Give me your keys. Hodges digs in his pocket and hands them over.
Jerome examines the fob and nods.
PKE, he says. Started to come into use during the 1990s, first as an accessory but pretty much standard equipment since the turn of the century. Do you know what it stands for?
As lead detective on the City Center massacre and frequent interviewer of Olivia Trelawney, Hodges certainly does. Passive keyless entry.
Right.
Jerome pushes one of the two buttons on the fob. At the curb, the parking lights of Hodges' Toyota flash briefly.
Now it's open.
He pushes the other button. The lights flash again.
Now it's locked. And you've got the key. He puts it in Hodges' palm. All safe and sound, right?
Based on this discussion, maybe not.
I know some guys from the college who have a computer club. I'm not going to tell you their names, so don't ask.
Wouldn't think of it.
They're not bad guys, but they know all the bad tricks. Hacking, cloning, info-jacking, stuff like that. They tell me that PKE systems are pretty much a license to steal. When you push the button to lock or unlock your car, the fob emits a low-frequency radio signal, a code. If you could hear it, it would sound like the boops and beeps you get when you speed dial a fax number. With me?
So far, yeah.
In the driveway, the girls chant Sally in the alley while Barbara Robinson darts deftly in and out of the loop, her sturdy brown legs flashing and her pigtails bouncing. My guys tell me that it's easy to capture that code if you have the right gadget. You can modify a garage door opener or a TV remote to do it. Only with something like that, you have to be really close, say within 20 yards. But you can also build one that's more powerful. All the components are available at your friendly neighborhood electronics store. Total cost about $100. Range up to 100 yards. You watch for the driver to exit the target vehicle. When she pushes the button to lock her car, you push your button. Your gadget captures the signal and stores it. She walks away. And when she's gone, you push your button again. The car unlocks, and you're in.
Hodges looks at his key, then at Jerome. This works?
Yes, indeed. My friends say it's tougher now. The manufacturers have modified the system so that the signal changes every time you push the button, but not impossible. Any system created by the mind of man can be hacked by the mind of man. You feel me?
Hodges hardly hears him, let alone feels him. He's thinking about Mr. Mercedes before he became Mr. Mercedes. He might have purchased one of the gadgets Jerome has just told him about, but it's just as likely he built it himself. And was Mrs. Trelawney's Mercedes the first car he ever used it on?
Unlikely. I have to check on car robberies downtown, he thinks, starting in, let's say, 2007, going right through until early spring of 2009. He has a friend in records, Marlowe Everett, who owes him one. Hodges is confident Marlowe will run an unofficial check for him without a lot of questions, and if she comes up with a bunch of reports where the investigating officer concludes that complainant may have forgotten to lock his vehicle, he'll know. In his heart, he knows already.
Mr. Hodges? Jerome is looking at him, a little uncertainly.
What is it, Jerome?
When you were working on the city center case, didn't you check out this PKE thing with the cops who handle auto theft? I mean, they have to know about it. It's not new. My friends say it's even got a name. Stealing the Peak.
We talked to the head mechanic from the Mercedes dealership, and he told us a key was used, Hodges says. To his own ears, the reply sounds weak and defensive. Worse, incompetent. What the head mechanic did, what they all did, was assume a key had been used. One left in the ignition by a ditzy lady none of them liked.
Jerome offers a cynical smile that looks odd and out of place on his young face.
There's stuff that people who work at car dealerships don't talk about, Mr. Hodges. They don't lie exactly, they just banish it from their minds. Like how airbag deployment can save your life but also drive your glasses into your eyes and blind you. The high rollover rate of some SUVs, or how easy it is to steal a PKE signal.
But the auto theft guys must be hip, right? I mean, they must. The dirty truth is Hodges doesn't know. He should, but he doesn't. He and Pete were in the field almost constantly, working double shifts and getting maybe 5 hours of sleep a night. The paperwork piled up. If there was a memo from auto theft, it will probably be in the case file somewhere. He doesn't dare ask his old partner about it, but realizes he may have to tell Pete everything soon, if he can't work it out for himself, that is. In the meantime, Jerome needs to know everything, because the guy Hodges is dicking with is crazy. Barbara comes running up, sweaty and out of breath.
Jay, can me and Hilda and Tanya watch regular show?
Go for it, Jerome says. She throws her arms around him and presses her cheek to his. Will you make us pancakes, my darling brother?
No.
She quits hugging and stands back.
You're bad. Also lazy.
Why don't you go down to Zoni's and get some Eggos?
No money is why.
Jerome digs into his pocket and hands her a five. This earns him another hug.
Am I still bad?
No, you're good. Best brother ever.
You can't go without your homegirls, Jerome says.
And take Odell, Hodges says.
Barbara giggles.
We always take Odell.
Hodges watches the girls bop down the sidewalk in their matching tees, talking a mile a minute and trading Odell's leash back and forth with a feeling of deep disquiet. He can hardly put the Robinson family in lockdown, but those three girls look so little. Jerome, if somebody tried to mess with them, would Odell
protect them?
Jerome is grave now.
With his life, Mr. H. With his life. What's on your mind?
Can I continue to count on your discretion?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm going to put a lot on you. But in return, you have to promise to call me Bill from now on.
Jerome considers.
It'll take some getting used to, but okay.
Hodges tells him almost everything. He admits where he spent the night, occasionally referring to the notes on his legal pad.
By the time he finishes, Barbara and her friends are returning from the Go-Mart, tossing a box of Eggos back and forth and laughing. They go inside to eat their mid-morning treat in front of the television. Hodges and Jerome sit on the porch steps and talk about ghosts.
20. Edgemont Avenue looks like a war zone, but being south of Lowbrier, at least it's a mostly white war zone, populated by the descendants of the Kentucky and Tennessee hill folk who migrated here to work in the factories after World War II. Now the factories are closed and a large part of the population consists of drug addicts who switched to brown tar heroin when Oxy got too expensive. Edgemont is lined with bars, pawn shops, and check cashing joints, all of them shut up tight on this Saturday morning.
the only two stores open for business are a Zoni's and the site of Brady's service call, Batool's Bakery. Brady parks in front, where he can see anybody trying to break into his cyber patrol Beetle, and totes his